Most people won't do good simply because it's good. People have too many other tempting motivations. I am reminded of when another woman admired Mae West's spectacular diamond ring with the exclamation, "My goodness!" And Mae said, "Goodness has nothing to do with it." Such are the realities of human motivations. Now, some do operate on principles that transcend egos, appetites, and opportunities. For some, virtue is its own reward. But for many others, pressures are needed to make virtue sufficiently rewarding. One of those is fear. There is the fear of getting caught, the fear of the loss of a good reputation, the fear of jeopardizing a good self-image, the fear of unduly complicating already complicated lives. As someone said to me recently, "Even if I wanted to have an affair, I'm too busy." Some do good out of habit. It is easier to do habitual things than to have to wrestle with the complications of conscious decisions to do something else. Some of us are strongly motivated by traditional family values, despite the fact that the parents of a good many 16-year-olds are convinced that nothing they ever said sank in. It's true that at 16, family values often sink not in, but into the murky depths of adolescent glandularity, though usually they eventually rise again. Some are moved by class patterns and some by cultural customs, both of which help us define what we believe is good or evil in our society at large and in the circle of friends whose values we value and whose rejections we fear. Often, too, we are moved by moral fashion. I can remember being considered suspect by some people in 1961 and following because I publicly opposed American involvement in Vietnam, and then congratulated for the same stand 8 years later. Moral fashion had shifted and I was finally in style. I guess that most, if not all of us, are motivated to believe and to act by some or all of these reasons, though the proportions may vary from person to person, from time to time, according to how involved our particular vested interests are on any particular occasion. As with almost everything, we human beings are a smorgasbord of thoughts and feelings. One of the classical moral motivations that we don't talk about much is the will of God. There are those who do. In fact, they claim to have a whole book on the subject. And having the book and firmly, even fanatically, believing it to be the word of God, they claim to have the inside track on God's will. Now there are millions of them, and only a few thousand of us. So please don't tell them what I'm about to say. Because I believe that we in the minority have a special moral obligation to protect their sensitivities. What I want to say is simply this. They are wrong. They do not know the will of God. I do. Well, a little anyway. Let me just give one example by explaining about the rabbit, the radish bag, and the will of God. It came to me in two stages. The first was when I was digging a trench along the bank of the Grass River some years ago. 2 feet down, I unearthed a plastic radish bag. I know it was a radish bag because that was revealed to me by big, bold black letters across its surface that said, "Radishes." By estimating the rate of silting, I concluded that the radish bag had been there for a dozen years or so, almost as good as the day it gave up its last radish. While that was a pretty pedestrian sort of revelation, I am accustomed to modest miracles. The other half of the revelation, if you will, came this August while I was cutting firewood. This time, I came across a freshly killed varying hare, more commonly known as a snowshoe rabbit. I won't go into the details, but on each of four consecutive days, I watched in fascination as an almost unblemished animal disintegrated and essentially disappeared in 4 days. At that point, the revelation came to me. An angel chorus said, "It is the will of God that whatever is on the earth shall go like the rabbit and not linger like the radish bag." Preposterous? I don't think so. Considering the modern blending of human ingenuity and idiocy, it strikes me as comparable to almost any revelation in the Bible, and better than some. Considering our ability and inclination to saturate the continental shelves with a trillion fragments of disintegrated styrofoam cups, to inundate the continents with acid rain, to submerge and bury radioactive waste as if out of sight could successfully be out of mind, to incinerate plastics into atmospheric gases, to poison soil and water in the name of agriculture, and to threaten life itself in the name of national defense and one or another political ism, the simple lesson of the radish bag looks to me as profound and divine a revelation as any of the Ten Commandments. On the other hand, considering the capacity of nature to turn a million years of leaves and lives into soil, soil that is the stuff of growth, considering the ability of the earth to recycle and purify a finite quantity of water endlessly, endlessly giving the planet every ocean, river, stream, and raindrop, and giving every living body, be it plant or animal, the fluids of life, from sap to blood to tears. Considering the evolved miracle of the intricate coordination of birth and death, growth and decay, it seems to me that the barely noticed disintegration of one single incarnation from its form as rabbit to its form as air and soil is as much a message from God as is being preached anywhere this Sunday morning. The difference between my self-proclaimed revelation and those biblical revelations that are so defensively accepted by our religious opposites is that mine is demonstrable. Go see it for yourself, along with 100 others. The other difference is that those reported in the book are finished, because the Bible of Judeo-Christianity is finished, as are the other scriptures of the world, the Vedas, the Gitas, and the Quran. But the Bible I was reading by the river and in the woods, the Bible of nature, both the earth's and ours, is the earth and sky, the Bible of the seasons, and cells is the book of life. Unless we read it and see it in new and different concepts of what I call God and what you may or may not, unless we turn its leaves and learn its lessons microscopically and genetically, telescopically and botanically, unless we heed its warnings and do the good no other Bible knew about, the house of our living shall, as the Judeo-Christian Bible says, fall, and the fall of that house shall be great. Thus saith the Lord.